From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane, sitting in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the White House mail. Not the thousands of letters the president receives, but the email correspondence between high-ranking officials. Our guest, Tom Blanton, fought the Reagan, Bush, and Clinton administrations to make it public. He won and has a new book, The White House Email. Also, we'll hear the man behind the music of the Boys Choir of Harlem. Walter Turnbull founded and directs the choir and has written a book about his work called Lift Every Voice. And commentator Milo Miles reviews the recent reissued music of gospel singers Sister Rosetta Tharpe and Mahalia Jackson. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Republican congressional leaders are proposing a budget deal that would include agreement on certain spending and tax cuts, leaving major areas of disagreement until after the November elections. UPI's Bill Small reports the offer is getting a positive response at the White House.
Spokesman Mike McCurry says the White House will look carefully at House Speaker Newt Gingrich's idea of combining budget cuts and an increase in the debt ceiling into a so-called down payment bill. And he says they would not reject such a proposal out of hand. McCurry says he also likes the tone of this morning's offers.
They seem to have a much more encouraged tone today than they did last night. So we're encouraged, too.
McCurry suggests the improvement in the tone of Republican offers may be due to, in his words, the Republican majority feeling they've suffered enough pain because of the government shutdown and wanting to avoid such a circumstance again. Bill Small at the White House.
U.S. peacekeeping troops in Bosnia have been warned that extremists, including an American believed to be in the country, might try to launch a terrorist attack against them. Defense Secretary William Perry says the U.S. forces have been placed on alert. Unrest is continuing today in the Persian Gulf nation of Bahrain. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
At least 2,000 people have reportedly been arrested in a crackdown by government security forces in Bahrain, according to opposition groups. Among those reportedly arrested are Abdul Amir al-Jamri, a prominent Shia religious leader and an outspoken critic of Bahrain's ruling monarchy. The oil-rich Persian Gulf nation has been rocked by political unrest since last year, which flared again this month. That's when opposition groups staged protests in the capital Manama, calling for the restoration of the country's parliament, which was disbanded 20 years ago. Bahrain is a regional financial center and the base of the U.S. Naval Forces Central Command. I'm Suni Khalid in Cairo.
The Food and Drug Administration has approved the nation's first zero-calorie artificial fat, Olestra, for use in snack foods such as potato chips. But the FDA is requiring that the products carry labels warning that Olestra might cause unpleasant side effects. Critics say Olestra can cause cramps and other gastrointestinal problems, and they say it can carry important vitamins and nutrients out of the body. The government says sales of new homes fell to a seven-month low in November, and the nation's industrial production barely budged last month. Analysts say the new reports today underscore the weakness of the economy during the fourth quarter of last year and could help persuade the Federal Reserve to cut interest rates next week to stimulate growth. On Wall Street at this hour, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up just over 39 points at 5,231 in heavy trading of 377 million shares. In the over-the-counter market, the Nasdaq Composite Index is up just over 12 points. This is NPR News. Tanzania has decided to allow an estimated 12,000 Rwandan refugees who crossed the border from Burundi last weekend to stay in the country temporarily. But a UN refugee agency says thousands of other Rwandans who were stopped at the border will not be allowed to cross. The Rwandans who fled the ethnic slaughter in their country in 1994 have been fleeing Burundi to escape ethnic unrest there. A first-time novelist from Scotland has won the prestigious Whitbread Book of the Year Award. NPR's Andy Bowers reports from London.
44-year-old Kate Atkinson won the Whitbread Prize for her novel Behind the Scenes at the Museum, the story of a working-class family in Atkinson's native city of York. Although she's won several prizes for her short stories, Atkinson had never before attempted a novel, a fact that astonished the judges. They said Atkinson's grand scale and confidence made it hard to believe that hers was a first effort. Atkinson beat out one of the world's best-known authors, Salman Rushdie, for the prize. London bookies had made Rushdie's new novel, The Moor's Last Sigh, this year's heavy favorite. Atkinson, who lives in Edinburgh, said she originally had modest hopes for her novel. She simply wanted to finish it before she died. Now she plans to write a second. I'm Andy Bowers in London.
Poland's Prime Minister Józef Aleksy has announced he's retiring for the good of his country, but he insists he is innocent of charges that he spied for Moscow for more than a decade. He made his statement hours after prosecutors announced they were investigating him. AT&T has announced it will close its chain of phone center stores, which are located in shopping malls nationwide. Some 2,500 workers will lose their jobs as a result. AT&T phone products will be sold in the future through other retailers and by catalog. President Clinton is in Louisville, where he will take part in a roundtable discussion of community policing efforts. He'll also speak about education at a high school before returning to Washington this evening. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoane in for Terry Gross. When Oliver North emailed John Poindexter in September 1986 about a secret CIA airstrip in Costa Rica used to supply the Contras, he never even stopped to think that message would ever see the light of day. But that informal memo about top secret information is now in a book with many other revealing, embarrassing, and inane intra-office communications called White House Email. The last three presidents all fought the public release of its email. Reagan tried to erase the computer backup tapes his last week in office. Bush signed a secret deal with the archivists of the United States just before midnight on his last day in office for him to take the email with him to Texas. And Clinton tried a technical maneuver to move the email out of reach of the Freedom of Information Act. But the National Security Archives, a nonprofit organization interested in the disclosure of government records, won its lawsuit to get the email released. Tom Blanton is the executive director of the National Security Archives and the man who went through the 45,000 email messages they received from the White House. I asked Tom Blanton why it was important to get the email released.
I think the most amazing thing to me about what we learned about the White House email system was that these top White House officials were really using this system to get around the normal kinds of records laws and the normal process of pushing paper, doing memos, writing decisions down in formal documents. And instead, they were chatting by computer and working out the policy, thinking the whole time that none of this email was going to survive. Nobody was ever going to get to see it. And so they were avoiding accountability, which in our democratic society, in a way, at the White House, is the ultimate sin. And so I think the reason it was so important for us to fight this thing for 7 years now, three different presidents, was precisely because the White House staff thought they were getting away with something. And that's, I think, the amazing thing about the email themselves is they thought nobody would ever read this stuff.
Well, three administrations, the Reagan administration, the Bush administration, and the Clinton administration really tried to block access to this email. What legal arguments did they use?
Well, the first time around, the Reagan administration actually tried to erase all the tapes. I mean, what's interesting about this, you know, Ollie North tried to delete his messages on his way out of the White House as the Iran-Contra was breaking, but they ended up being saved on all these backup tapes. Well, at the end of the Reagan administration, Colin Powell was the National Security Advisor, and he ordered all these backup tapes to be recycled, overwritten with new data. We went to court when we found out about this with just a day or a day and a half left in the Reagan administration in January of 89 and got a court order to stop the destruction. And the fundamental argument the government made was, oh, these email, they're just like little telephone message slips. They're just, you know, a name and maybe a number and please call me back. There was nothing substantive about them. And they went ahead with that argument even though we could show them hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of email messages written by the National Security Advisor of the United States, John Poindexter, and Oliver North, laying out all of their Iran-Contra dealings. This is the place where they really wrote it all down.
Is there anything, though, private and off-limits at the White House when it comes to conversations and documents?
Absolutely. And the government does have some very strong privacy protections, particularly the U.S. Privacy Act, where they don't have to release any email that is about, say, a staff person's family or medical appointments or problems or personal finances or even, you know, employment reviews and that kind of thing. That's all covered, and I totally support that. In fact, you know, during the litigation, every time the government made a privacy claim and said, oh, this piece of email is really personal and private, or this section of an email is personal, we didn't challenge it as plaintiffs. We said, no, we agree. We think any good freedom of information regime has to have good privacy protections, or else it's a farce. The government is exercising its power by trampling on our individual rights and the rights of employees.
Do you think there's a need, though, for public officials to be able to speak off the record, off the cuff, without being exposed and without having the fear of being exposed?
Yes, I think there is. And at the same time, I think that has to be limited. Because if you have an absolute right for public officials to speak off the record in order to speak candidly and have really honest discussions, well, then there's no way for anybody, any of the rest of us as citizens or journalists or scholars, to really find out what happened, what went into the decision. And so I think all of our laws, including the Freedom of Information Act, have a kind of a balance in a way which says, you know, there are exemptions to freedom of information for deliberative material that would chill expressions of views. Under the Presidential Records Act, you have to wait 5 or 10 years after a president leaves office before you can get the documents of his or her top advisors. And I think that's a reasonable balance. And here in the White House email, though, they weren't striking any balance at all. They weren't saying, oh, we're going to set it aside for 10 years from now. They were saying, we're going to destroy it. You'll never get it.
Do you see email as the equivalent of a diary or the equivalent of the White House tapes that Nixon made when he was in office?
It's closer to the White House tapes because it's conversation by computer, and it has a lot of that instantaneous quality of a phone call where people or this White House staffers had an email note on their screen and they just typed in their response and zap, sent it off, and it instantly arrived at the recipient's computer. And it has a real off-the-cuff and raw quality to it that makes it amazing reading. And I think that's what it is, more than say a diary. Each of these email messages was sent to another top White House staff person or several such staff people. So from my way of thinking, that's much closer to a Watergate tape, and it's much closer to exactly the kind of record that history requires us to save.
You know what I found a curious omission, at least the email that you published in your book? There's mm-hmm. no presidential email. We see no email from either President Bush or President Reagan.
Isn't that amazing? I think it's a generational thing in a way, because we know, for example, that Bill Clinton and Al Gore both use the computer and both send email, and Gore has actually gone on some of these online chats and responded to people's email, but there's no evidence in anything that we've seen during the 7 years of the court battle that either President Reagan or President Bush ever sat down at a computer terminal and typed out an email. If you remember George Bush and that supermarket scanner incident where he didn't quite know what the barcode right. thing was all about, you can see that these guys were not exactly computer literate. But what is amazing is that all of their top staff were using it. And in fact, most of the business, certainly in the national security staff at the White House, was all taking place on email.
You just said that all of the business of the National Security Council was done on email. Is that right?
What's amazing to me is how much of the business was done on email. What might ordinarily take place in a conference call among staff or at a staff meeting, by the 1980s, the staff was so large. I mean, you had something like 150 full-time professionals just working on the national security staff at the White House. Those folks couldn't even get in the same room together to work out projects. And it was very difficult for them, according to their own email and their own memoirs, even to reach each other on the phone because they were all tied up in meetings. You look at some of the email schedules for some of these people, like Colin Powell, we have his daily schedules that were put up on the email system for other staffers to look at. He was scheduled down to the 2-minute increments during a normal working day at the White House. And because of that, because of the phone tag and the incredibly tight schedules, they had to use email just to communicate, just to let each other know what they were doing, to get decisions moved forward, to alert people, you got to sign off on this memo, or King Hussein is coming to town and we got to set up the Oval Office for this. This is how they got it done. It was instant. You could be guaranteed that people would sit down at the end of the day and look at it, whereas you might never get a phone call returned for days at a time.
What then is the overall impression that you get looking at the email that came out of both the Bush and the Reagan White House?
I think the first and really overall impression is just how candid it is. I mean, we may never see email like this again now that my book is out, but at the time, they really, the White House staff really believed none of it was going to survive, that my book would never exist, that the public would never see their email. So they said things about each other, about key players on Capitol Hill, about, you know, foreign dictators ranging, you know, Noriega to Saddam, or, you know, Bob Dole to Ross Perot, that I don't think they would ever have said in public. They would never have said if they knew it was going to become public. It's like talk. It's chat in an interesting way. It's very different from many the other declassified documents that I've seen over the years that are much more formal, much more written for the file or for history or as a official decision document. This is the way they actually talk when they think nobody is listening.
Well, a fair amount of the email does deal with what came to be called the Iran-Contra scandal. This is a piece of American history that you have looked at through official documents and through testimony. Did you learn anything else, anything new and different about what happened in that chapter in the administration history that you didn't know from official documents?
We learned a lot about Iran-Contra, I think, through this email. The first time around, the email that came out early in Iran-Contra really was the way that investigators like the Tower Commission could even figure out who did what to whom and find out that Ollie North wasn't a lone cowboy out there. He was part of the herd. He was regularly communicating with his bosses. But the new email that came out as a result of our lawsuit has incredible details that were censored the first time around when the first set of email was released. So you have North and Poindexter and others trying to intimidate Oscar Arias, the future Nobel Prize winner, president of Costa Rica, into not exposing their little secret operations in Central America. And you have this extraordinary email, for example, about Manuel Noriega, where at one point Noriega approaches Ollie North, who says, I've developed a pretty good relationship with him over the years, fascinating little detail in itself, and offers to bump off the Sandinista leaders if the White House would help him, Noriega, quote, clean up his image, unquote. And so North writes an email describing all this to his boss, the National Security Advisor. The boss writes back and says, well, you know, we can't get involved in any assassination, but, you know, he might have some assets for sabotage. And, you know, quote, I have nothing against him other than his illegal activities, unquote. Which my jaw just hit the floor.
So what does that tell you? I mean, as you say, these are our officials thinking out loud, talking to each other in what they consider to be very private conversations.
Exactly.
What does that tell you?
It tells you how far they were willing to go in the 1980s to pursue these policies that they knew President Reagan was strongly behind supporting the Nicaraguan Contras. What the email tells you is that the top White House staff were willing to cut deals with known murderers and drug traffickers. Noriega had been exposed 3 months before this email on the front page of the New York Times, had been exposed as a murdering opponents and part of the cartel money laundering apparatus and so forth. That's why he needed help from the White House to clean up his image. And yet they were willing to work out arrangements with him. It's an amazing, astonishing degree of willingness to bend and break the law, I think.
That's Tom Blanton, our guest today on Fresh Air. He's the executive director of the National Security Archive and the author of a new book called White House Email, and it's email was gotten through the courts from the Reagan and Bush White House. We'll be back after a very short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tom Blanton, executive director of the National Security Archive and author of White House Email. There's some very public players, a McFarland, North, Poindexter, public because of a lot of the testimony that they had to give as a result of Iran-Contra. What kind of portrait emerges from them from the email? Do you get a different picture of them than someone might get just from their public testimony?
Well, In the email, you definitely see more of the sense of humor, particularly from Oliver North, who is one of the most distinctive voices on the whole email system. He has this one, I think, very funny email that he's writing to another staffer where he says, you know, "Oh, Lord, I lost the slip and broke one of the high heels. Forgive, please. We'll return the slip on Monday. Your pal, the Ayatollah." And you can hear sort of him laughing and the recipient. As it turns out, it was both a serious and a funny email. He had just come back from some overseas undercover mission, and he was apparently wearing a disguise. And so this senior staffer, who was a woman at the White House, offered him the next time he needed a disguise to take some of her dresses and wigs. And so he's writing back thanking her for this with a little joke. You get a sense of that personal voice, which is, to me, very fascinating. Or another example, which I really enjoyed, Colin Powell is National Security Advisor. His top aide asks him in late 1987, "Gee, you feel, you know, secure, you know, going back and forth to the office? Are you, you know, you sufficient guards, security, whatever?" And Powell says, "Yeah, well, I feel fine. I try to vary my schedule a little bit to cover the threat." And quote, I had an alarmed house when I lived at Fort McNair earlier this year. Pain in the neck scared hell out of the family initially, and then became amusing when the MPs assaulted the house every time the alarm misfired, unquote. You really get a feel. That's Colin Powell's real voice there, and it humanizes these folks at the top of the power pyramid within the U.S. government. I think that's one of the great things about the email is you actually see them not only as policymakers, not only as very powerful people, but also as human beings.
Well, one of the things I found, and this, I guess, is part of the inane entries of email, was a letter having to do with toe markers and a particular White House event and the question of making sure that everyone was seated at the proper table and that the kind of protocol of a lunch or a dinner was followed to the letter of the law. And I just thought, isn't it interesting how these details can take on such magnitude?
Exactly. And how many people on the White House staff it takes to take care of these details. I mean, that particular email message was arranging for an Oval Office meeting where King Hussein of Jordan was going to come in and sit down with President Reagan. And it's just amazing that the email is almost 2 pages long and all the people they have to inform and where you put toe markers for people to stand and how they screwed up the last couple of times. And it's amazing how much work goes into what the Reagan administration was known for, which was beautiful photo ops. The whole idea was get up a nice visual that shows the president, you know, talking mano a mano with top world leaders that makes him look more presidential and scores points politically. I mean, it's fascinating to see how many inane details go into these spectacular photo ops.
What do you think the effect of publishing this email is having or is going to have on the Clinton White House? Do you think that they're going to be more self-conscious, more circumspect when it comes to sending email from one person to the next?
I do think so. And I think that effect already even happened in the Bush White House because we had won in the first round of our lawsuit to save the tapes from the Reagan years. And my bet is there are something like 4,800 tape cartridges from the Bush White House that our lawsuit saved. My bet is that email will not be quite as candid as what Ollie North wrote back in the mid-1980s. And I bet in the Clinton years, it will be even less candid, or people just won't use the email to try to make their communications. And at the same time, there's something about the email that just draws out that candidness, almost in spite of yourself, the instantaneousness of the response and the off-the-cuff response. You know, if you read some of the email that even now has been turned over by some of the Clinton White House staff to congressional investigators of this or that different affair, it's amazingly candid for what it does say.
Now, how candid are you when you email, knowing that whatever you say could be saved and found by somebody else?
You bet. Well, in my book, I suggest something I call the front page rule. And actually, believe it or not, I got this idea from the CIA. They announced about 2 years ago that before they undertake any covert actions these days in the post-Cold War era, that they judge the proposed covert action by a variety of criteria, the cost and the benefit and so forth. One of the criteria they judge it by is, will we be proud of this covert action? When, not if, it shows up on the front page. And if we'd be proud of it, then they think, oh, we should go forward. Well, in a way, that's not such a bad rule for me or for any other email user to follow, because I think we might all do with a little more civility and a little less flaming in our electronic communications.
So when you want to say something that might end up on the front page, but you feel like you don't want it to, does that mean you pick up the phone?
Yeah, I think most people do. Sometimes, you know, if the key question for email users who expect some privacy from their email is, who else gets to see it? Mm-hmm. Where does it exist? Who's the systems operator? Who runs the mainframe or the server or the network that has your email? And I think one of the lessons of the White House email case is that we all ought to find that out, because those folks, those systems operators, they have a lot of power over our privacy and over our information. So if you don't know where it exists, go find out. And then also think about who else gets to see it. I mean, if you send your email over networks like America Online or across the internet, it's protected in that electronic communication. But if you use email within I'm at George Washington University, if I just use email within the university system, the university has some rules about access, but really the systems operators at the university's computer center could, if they wanted to, read my email. Practically speaking, they don't, because there are thousands of students and other users. It would overwhelm them to try to read it. But if you're in a corporate environment, there's some real consequences. There's a major case out at Epson in California where a woman got fired because in her email, which she thought was private, she made some comments about a supervisor, and the systems operator gave it to the supervisor, and the courts, all the way up to the California Supreme Court, said, oh, that email doesn't belong to you, the email writer. It belongs to the company that gave you the computers and that set up the network internally. So it's, I think, a good lesson for all of us from the White House staff. You know where your email is backed up and think about it as if it could be public someday.
Well, Tom Blanton, thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me, Marty.
Tom Blanton is the executive director of the National Security Archives and author of the new book, White House Email. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we meet Walter Turnbull, founder and director of the Boys Choir of Harlem, and commentator Milo Miles shares some rediscovered recordings from gospel singers Sister Rosetta Tharpe and Mahalia Jackson. This is Fresh Air. Music critic Milo Miles has decided that gospel performers might be right to scorn secular audiences. After all, he says, crossover success did strange things to the careers of two of the grandest female gospel singers, Sister Rosetta Tharpe and Mahalia Jackson.
This train, the train, this train. This train is a clean train, this train. This train is a clean train, everybody ride it in Jesus' name. This train's a clean train, this train.
In the early 1940s, Sister Rosetta Tharpe was the most popular gospel singer in America, but she died in near obscurity 30 years later. At the time, all of her recordings were hard to find. Starting in the middle 1950s, Mahalia Jackson was the most famous gospel singer in the world, synonymous with the form. She died a celebrated legend in 1972, yet the purest examples of her old-fashioned black church hymns, her strongest work, really, remained collector's items for years. Now the neglected sides of both Tharpe and Jackson have been reissued. They are wondrous rewards in themselves, but also show as well as any gospel numbers how church music interacts with the blues, rock and roll, and of course, soul.
Now what you hear me singing, hear the words that I'm saying. Wash my soul with water from on high. While the world of love is around me, evil thoughts do bind me. But if you leave me, I'll die. You just hide me in the bosom. Tell the storm of life is over. Oh, rock me in the cradle of thou love.
With her twanging, banging guitar and her flair for hitting the beats in the butt with a stick, Sister Rosetta Tharpe is clearly a rock foremother. Elvis cited her as an influence. And on a number of occasions, she cut mildly raunchy blues with big band thumper Lucky Millinder and others. For this, Sister Tharpe was vilified by the church faithful, and it reputedly cost her her core religious audience. Yet the truth is that Sister Tharpe sounds more uncomfortable in her secular numbers than many gospel birds who flocked on the wild side. She wants religious numbers to be roughhouse, but without a doubt sacred. Sister Tharpe is so exuberant she can even make the moral rigor of religion, whether it's God don't like it or this train don't carry no liars, sound not only right, but like a lot of fun. Sister Tharpe understands terror and anguish, though. Her harrowing standout is I Look Down the Line, included on the first volume of her complete recorded works, 1938 to 1944, in chronological order.
Then I look down the line and I wonder. And I wonder. And I wonder. I look down the line and I wonder. Just to see how.
Mahalia Jackson is a little different. Even when she's all out, there's a majestic poise to her delivery.
Well, go to where I died, come on,
oh, yes.
In the New Jerusalem.
Oh, yes.
Go to walk the streets of home.
Oh, yes.
In the homeland of the soul.
Oh, yes.
I'm going to view the hosts in white.
Oh, yes.
Thank him.
Thank you,
all is done for.
Born in New Orleans and an unabashed disciple of blues empress Bessie Smith, Mahalia Jackson had an odd recording career. She first entered a studio in 1937 when her style wasn't quite developed. Then not again until 1946, when she signed to the little but mighty Apollo label. Her numbers there made her a cult sensation, and in 1954, she began cutting her famous sides for Columbia. Many of her Columbia tracks can raise the heart and clean the spirit, but overall there are just too many of them, with too often trite material and too much fancy production. Now, after a very long absence, the Apollo sides are back on two budget-priced CDs. Hallelujah.
There are those who are willing to pay the dear price that they might have.
The key to the Apollo sides is the plain accompaniment. In particular, you can always hear the piano of Mildred Falls, who played behind Mahalia for decades. Indeed, Mahalia's Apollo numbers are so dense with passion that you can only listen closely to two or three at a time. In return, you get, in my humble opinion, the finest recorded versions of the Lord's Prayer and Silent Night, and down-to-earth spirituals unmatched anywhere.
Silent.
Yes, Mahalia went out like a queen at her funeral. The star performer was the glorious Aretha Franklin, raised in gospel but rewarded as the Queen of Soul. By then, a golden era of church music had passed, and gospel was more adored for its influence on secular music.
Milo Miles is a music critic living in Cambridge. He reviewed the music of gospel singers Sister Rosetta Tharpe and Mahalia Jackson. This is Fresh Air. When When Dr. Walter Turnbull founded the Boys Choir of Harlem in 1968, he had no idea the impact the choir would have on its members, on the music world, and on his own life as well. Turnbull was born and raised in rural Mississippi and was the first member of his family to go to college. After graduation, he went to New York to pursue a career in opera. In his spare time, he founded a small boys' choir which grew in numbers and popularity and eventually became the Boys Choir of Harlem. Now, almost 30 years later, the choir has 1,000 alumni, performed all over the world, established a program for girls, and founded a school for choir members, 98% of whom graduate and go on to college. Walter Turnbull has written a book, Lift Every Voice, about the making of the choir, his musical and educational philosophy, and his own life. Before we hear from Walter Turnbull, let's listen to the Boys Choir of Harlem singing I Trust in God from their CD, The Sound of Hope. Started a boys' choir, something that you wanted to do. This was at a church, the Ephesus Boys' Choir. This was almost 30 years ago. What was your vision? What did you want to do?
Well, originally, when I went to Ephesus, I was in graduate school right up down the hill at the Manhattan School of Music. And the church was on the same street, but just down the hill in Harlem, where I was living. And it was... the idea was just to give kids something to do. And then we began to really realize that there were hundreds and hundreds of kids who wanted to be involved, who wanted to do something positive, to just to be involved. But as I began to teach and began to work with kids, it began to grow. The needs of the children really dictated that it grow. It was important to sing, but then there were all the other things that needed to happen, the counseling, all of the social issues that had to be addressed. I mean, whether a kid had a coat or whether he was cold or whether the family was breaking up or there was nobody for them or whether they were going to have to go into a foster home. All of those things became a part of the milieu that decided what the Boys Choir of Harlem program should be.
Well, you wanted to change the name. Actually, the church, Ephesus Church, burned down, and you changed the name to the Boys Choir of Harlem.
Right.
Many people were shocked. And the name Harlem was a name they weren't sure they wanted to be associated with a boys choir.
Absolutely. It's even some of the people who lived in Harlem. Because Harlem had, by now, had a very negative connotation in terms of ghetto, in terms of poverty, in terms of... despite that, the great tradition that Harlem had, I mean, the years of the Renaissance and music and poetry and all of the great things that that we gave the world. But there were people in the church who, well, didn't want to have anything to do with the name Harlem. And I just kind of stuck with it, you know, insisted that we that the name should be the Boys Choir of Harlem because the kids were from Harlem and they needed to do that.
You write in your book that you didn't want a European sound.
Yeah.
When you say that, what is a European sound to you?
Well, to me, the sound is very different than the sound of young black voices. And there is a difference in sound. And being a singer, I'd always been aware of that, always aware of the difference in sound. I mean, I could hear it, on the radio, in the opera house, and there was a difference in the sound. Now, when it came to boy choir, there were people who really felt that only the European sound was, in quote, correct.
Are you talking then about a certain kind of rhythm, a certain kind of diction, a certain...
No, a sound. I mean, actually, what the sound sounds like. I mean, there's head voice, and there's and the head voice of the bone structure of the young black boy is different than the head structure of the Germanic. Now, that doesn't mean that there are not many that are the same, but there is a difference of sound. I mean, and in my opinion, a warmer sound.
Let me make sure I understand what you mean when you say head voice. And mm-hmm. Are you talking about literally how music reverberates in a person's head?
Exactly.
And then goes out their mouth?
Exactly. Exactly. And bone structure has a lot to do with, how that sound comes out. You know, all of those kinds of nuances, are really important to sound.
As you mentioned, many of these boys had chaotic family lives, mm-hmm. and many of the neighborhoods that they live in are mm-hmm. are really very dangerous and difficult places to live. Many of them didn't mm-hmm. have fathers as well. When did you realize that teaching music was not going to be enough for these kids?
Oh, very, very early on, probably before we incorporated in 1975, I began to understand that we needed to address a myriad of problems, of social issues. And that's when I hired a counselor, mm-hmm. a professional, someone who knew something about, social psychology and how to deal with people. And the counselors and I began to work together and sort of began to develop the program that we have, which is very unique in that, we work with the parents, we work with the student, we work with the families, just every aspect of the child's life, having an impact on every part of his life, as well as singing.
For the kids in the choir... is it cool to be in the Boys Choir of Harlem?
Oh, yeah. It's cool to be in the Boys Choir of Harlem because you get a chance to travel the world. See, those are the little perks, So that works in my favor.
Well, I was wondering, because not all, 14- or 15-year-old boys want to be associated with a boys choir that sings, songs that they're not going to hear on uh-huh. the top 40.
That's right. But then again, we do sing some songs that they hear on the top 40 because you have to make the repertoire very wide. I mean, we do everything from jazz to gospel to hip-hop. And as a matter of fact, give them opportunity to write some songs.
How do you select someone to be in the choir? Are you looking for the best possible voice?
No, not necessarily the best possible voice. Some kids need the choir more than others. And so that is a factor as well when we are auditioning.
Are there kids you've had to give up on?
Yes. And of course, that hurts a lot, because I lose some. I've learned to deal with it a little better as I've gotten older. But you do lose some, no matter what you do.
Oh,
there is a time in which a boy's voice will begin to change.
Mm-hmm.
How do you accommodate, I guess, that change into then this sound of a boys' choir?
Well, Boys' Choir of Harlem has a very unique kind of system where we work with changed voices, and so we work with them through the change.
Right.
And so they move to different sections because we use SATB. So we have sopranos, altos, tenors, and basses, and I use the young, of course, the trebles, and then they might move on down as their voices, you know, change. It might mean that a kid might do, if he's having particular problems with, the transition, mm-hmm. and maybe laying off for a couple of months or 6 months. It doesn't matter. But you have plenty of things to do with them because you're teaching them academics. You're working with them socially. They have their basketball teams. They have their the wonderful things. And they can still sing. You know, they can study their music theory and composition. There are plenty of things to do.
Walter Turnbull is the founder and director of the Boys Choir of Harlem.
Don't compare my singing to my swinging. Keep them separate and distinct.
As well you should.
Don't compare my singing to my swinging. Don't make a fuss when it's obvious.
They're both wise. Do, 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 do. They're both wise. Good.
Coming up, we'll hear about commentator Dagoberto Gilb's visit to New York City. This is Fresh Air. Writer Dagoberto Gilb is from El Paso, Texas. In December, he visited New York City when it was cold and everything seemed bleak.
I had recently arrived from the desert where I live, where it gets cold in the winter too, but the sky is all around and above. Bright baby blue in the daylight, dark navy blue and twinkly after the sun sets. Unlike New York City, where the night sky, which is only straight up, was as black as the streets below. And it was so cold, cold with a wet, scalding wind so mean I imagined it must be blowing in off the infamous East River, where dead bodies are always disposed of. No, I was not at my happiest this particular evening. I was walking those blackened streets, and trash was flying up and along and by. Shards of cardboard boxes and plastic wrappings, styrofoam and paper cups, those pretty store bags and the most and least gourmet of disposable plates and take-home containers from the delis and pizza houses and those multi-exotic restaurants, now all mashed and stained into sidewalk tile. I pass a soleless shoe, cigarette wrappers and butts, a broken umbrella, a crushed pen, a flattened stereo speaker, gum, half a suitcase, beer bottles. On an abandoned cobblestone street, I pass a hungry blackened man under a frayed knit watchman suddenly jack his head out of an even blacker shadow like a macabre harlequin, then as suddenly bob it back into the unseeable darkness. I go up a trembling elevator through a long, dimly lit hall. Another visitor, from Holland, is sitting at a table drinking coffee black. He is with a black woman from Brooklyn, and she too is drinking her coffee black. There are no cockroaches in Holland, he is telling her, because they are not allowed. If a cockroach would be discovered in someone's home, that person would be required to call a government agency which must investigate immediately. A Dutch SWAT team, I contribute, the woman from Brooklyn laughs. This subject is brought up because she told him her last job was as an exterminator, and he thought she said Terminator as in the movie of that title. There is no such occupation in Holland. Both the woman from Brooklyn and I are astonished by this information. He says the thought of cockroaches, he has never seen one, terrifies him. She used to be disgusted by them too. But after a few years on her job, she explains, she came to understand what they were, where they came from, why they behaved as they did. Did we know that cockroaches, impregnated only one time, will continually have babies the rest of their mature life? Did we know that cockroaches, if they need to, can change their sex in order to reproduce? The Dutchman groans. He shakes his head. I never want to see a cockroach, he says. After some contemplation, the woman from Brooklyn says, I bet Holland doesn't have cockroaches because it is such a green country. The Dutchman thinks with his hand over his mouth, moving his blue eyes, and speaks from under his palm. I love concrete. I hate green. Borneo is green. He cried for the first 2 weeks there. He wished he'd never gone. The first thing was the leeches. They were this big. No, bigger. They were the darkest green. They had eyes, and they watched from the trees. They stared and waited. Every day, he and his partner would walk in wet clothes with insecticide powder all over the body. Danger and pain were everywhere. The Dutchman learned to wrap his genitals with plastic because in the rivers there are tiny fish attracted to urine. Get careless and they will go up the penis and lodge themselves and swell. They can be removed only by surgery, and they must be or else, though there is no surgery in the jungle and no time once it happens. He and his partner had two sets of clothes, wet and dry. At night, they would powder their body and put on the dry clothes to sleep. One morning, his partner was changing back into the wet ones and began to howl. He hadn't powdered his genitals, and now his testicles were crusted green. Without knowing it, he'd slept near an absent boar's nest, and hundreds of hungry ticks who thrived on boar found his warmest flesh. Clenching her teeth, the woman from Brooklyn says, our worst bugs are cockroaches. The Dutchman shivers. I hope I never see a cockroach here in New York because I think New York is such a beautiful city. And right then I felt better, and I said, it is. It really is a beautiful city, isn't it?
Writer Dagoberto Gilb lives in El Paso, Texas. Danny Miller is Fresh Air's senior producer. Joyce Lieberman was today's engineer, and Alan Tu directed today's program. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moss Cohen.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, classical pianist Leon Fleischer. More than 30 years ago, he lost the use of his right hand but didn't give up playing. Now his hand is on the mend, and he just performed using both hands at Carnegie Hall. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.